Does the hormone progesterone have another application?
Novel therapies for preventing blood clots.
A new cancer pathway seems to come to fruition.
And healthcare disparities in the United States.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, hosted on December 12th, 2014. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and president of the Texas Tech University Health Science Center in El Paso and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think the New England Journal of Medicine is going to owe us this week because every single study that we're talking about is actually published in that journal this time.
Yeah, this issue was rich in a lot of studies that I thought were fairly interesting. Where do you want to start, Elizabeth?
I think, if you don't mind, we can start with the thing I served up as a new cancer pathway. It's not a new cancer pathway, of course. It's something that's been identified for a long time, but it looks like manipulating this pathway in cancer therapy, the PD-1 pathway, may actually have some practical application now.
Yeah, you talked about this new pathway. I guess it would be helpful for our listeners to know is we've been trying to use the immune system to help fight cancer cells for decades now, and we've not had a tremendous amount of success, but this particular therapy may in fact prove useful in that regard. Cancer cells are somehow able to deploy different mechanisms to limit either the detection by our immune defenses or by activation. And they do that oftentimes through a normal pathway called programmed cell death, or PD-1 pathway. What that means is that we obviously don't want our immune system to run amok. We don't want it to attack our own tissues. And so many of our tissues have a protein, what's called a PD-1 ligand. It's expressed on the tissue, and when our own immune system cells see it, it inactivates the immune system. Well, unfortunately, many types of cancers can do this. Melanoma is one, and Hodgkin's lymphoma is another type of cancer that can do that. We now have in our armamentarium antibodies to PD-1 protein that earlier this year were shown to be very effective in people that had refractory or recurrent melanoma. They used the same therapy to treat patients that have had recurrent or resistant Hodgkin's lymphoma. So these are patients that have already had radiation therapy or chemotherapy, in some cases had stem cell transplant, and in 23 of those patients, they received a novel antibody called nivolumab. There was an 87% response rate. About 1 in 5 patients had complete remission. The remainder had partial remission and a longer progression-free survival. So this is potentially very good news.
This is a really interesting model, of course, Hodgkin's disease, because, gosh, those cancer cells are sitting right there in the middle of the immune system, and somehow they manage to escape detection and subsequent clearance.
Elizabeth, you're right, because there are very few number of cancer cells surrounded by a lot of immune cells that really aren't very active. Hence, this new type of immune therapy could be very effective in these types of patients.
Of course, we get these big kicks out of this because we're nerds and we like these kind of things. How applicable do you think this particular pathway might be in other types of cancer?
Well, I think it's going to be very applicable. However, there's still a lot of stuff we don't really know. What is the best type of antibody or the best way to inhibit this pathway? How do we minimize side effects? And how do we prevent autoimmune disease? And as we know, oftentimes if you have one type of therapy in a cancer cell, there's some sort of an escape mechanism that uses an alternative pathway. But again, I think this is a really novel, exciting type of therapy using our immune system to help fight or keep in check cancer cells.
Yep, it's a great strategy. It definitely looks very attractive, and unquestionably, we're going to be hearing more about this. Since we're staying in the same journal, and that's the last time I'm going to say this because I'm assuming everybody has heard that, let's turn now to the potential utility of progesterone in traumatic brain injury.
This is particularly important because there are literally millions of individuals across the United States that have sustained traumatic brain injury, over 5 million. That obviously has long implications. These people have severe disabilities, oftentimes need intensive therapy. We've tried 30 different things now trying to prevent the neurologic consequences of traumatic brain injury. Because even though someone has that immediate injury, there are subsequent mechanisms. There's inflammatory mechanisms, the swelling of the brain, and continued cell death of the neurons that occurs even after the injury. So a lot of different types of medications have been thrown at these individuals to try to prevent the neurologic dysfunction. Progesterone seemed to have, at least in animal studies and in very small numbers of patients, some protective benefits. So hence, the rationale for doing two large studies, and in both of these studies, patients were given progesterone intravenously within 4 hours, and compared to placebo, with the outcome seeing what was their neurologic function over the next 6 months. And unfortunately, what both of these well-designed randomized controlled trials showed was there was no benefit of early use of IV progesterone.
That's unfortunate. I'm sorry to hear that, but gosh, am I glad to see this publication of a negative result.
And I think what this tells us is that for small studies in which a therapy appears to be promising, we actually need to do larger randomized controlled trials before we unleash therapy to the general population.
Since we're talking about research and new therapies and all that, let's turn to this idea that a new pathway may be involved in a more, let's say, effective blood thinner. And when I say effective, what I mean is maybe one with fewer side effects.
Over the years we've been podcasting, we've talked about the inherent benefits and risk of anticoagulants or antithrombotic agents, blood thinning agents, in a number of different circumstances. For people that have had surgery and are prone to developing blood clots in their legs, for example, people that have atrial fibrillation, irregular heart rhythm. And I think it's fair to say that whenever we identify a more effective blood thinner, it also is more likely to cause bleeding. So we really don't have any commercially available blood thinning agents that really don't induce bleeding. Hence the rationale for identifying agents which might be effective for preventing blood clots but not actually causing increased bleeding. And that was the source of this particular study. Instead of inhibiting factors that are already in our blood system, this is a technique that actually inhibits the translation of the DNA to the actual protein through what's called messenger RNA or mRNA. It's the use of compounds called antisense. So it doesn't inhibit what's there, it just prevents one particular factor from being made. This is factor 11. And in individuals that had knee surgery were randomized to receive conventional blood thinning therapy with enoxaparin or this new targeted blood thinner, antisense therapy. What we discovered with the newer therapy, it was significantly better at preventing clots with no increase in the bleeding rate.
I'm assuming, of course, that these folks were receiving this therapy over the short term. While this sounds like a really wonderful strategy to me, I wonder what would happen over the long haul if we were giving chronic anticoagulation.
That's an excellent question. And in fact, one of the things I need to mention, for this particular therapy, it was actually initiated about 36 days before the elective knee surgery. It did require injections. And to your point, Elizabeth, could this be an effective therapy for people that need long-term anticoagulation, specifically for those having atrial fibrillation? This is just a proof of concept. It was done in a small number of patients, so this is very early on, and we really don't know what the long-term side effects are. A potential new therapy, a new pathway, exciting news.
It is exciting because it suggests that we're targeting something very specific and hopefully avoiding all the rest of the impact that such things often have.
And this particular factor really wasn't known to be involved with causing blood clots after surgery.
Excellent. Finally, let's turn to our age-old problem, one that we keep approaching from many different angles. What about equity among folks who are recipients of healthcare in the U.S. healthcare system?
This was actually two studies. These two studies indicate that the differences in how we deliver care to patients in various racial or ethnic groups has narrowed nationally, but nevertheless, the health outcomes remain worse for blacks than for whites. So here are the two studies, and I think they give us insight. When they looked at hospitalized patients who had been hospitalized from 2005 to 2010 for an acute heart attack or heart failure or pneumonia, what they found is that the racial ethnic differences decreased substantially for the processes of care. That is, what do clinicians do for patients? Do they prescribe the cholesterol-lowering medications? They put them on aspirin. These are all recommendations. The disparities for those seem to decrease nationwide. However, when they looked at Medicare patients and looked at African Americans versus whites, African Americans or the black patients had worse outcomes in terms of controlling blood pressure, cholesterol, and sugar was worse for African Americans than for whites, although it's somewhat narrowed, the one exception being in the West. We're controlling inpatient things very well, but all the stuff that happens outside when the patient gets out of the hospital seems to be a huge disparity still. What that would suggest is that if we're going to eliminate disparities, we actually have to give truly patient-centered care that are sensitive to the particular ethnic group or their culture that we're trying to treat. You have to address the patient's beliefs, their behaviors, and their social and economic challenges as well.
Takes a village.
That's an excellent point.
We'll see how well that gets translated, right? It might take a little time to get us up to speed on that one.
It's going to require changing how we deliver care. It's a fee for service now, so we reward volumes and procedures, but we don't actually reward prevention. It doesn't actually address the social, economic, or the cultural factors that drive these disparities. So we have to align our incentive system with what we want our outcomes to be.
Really good message. On that note, I'll reveal that this week on the blog, I'm going to do the PD-1 inhibitors, of course. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.